CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. In late April of this year, Lodestar Media, formerly known as Glacier Media, closed down three of its news publications, the Burnaby Now, the New Westminster Record, and the Tri-City News. The main reason given for the closures were budget constraints. But these closures also drastically decreased the level of local news available in the municipalities of Burnaby, New Westminster, Port Coquitlam, Coquitlam, and Port Moody. In June of this year, four journalists who previously worked with the closed Lodestar Media publications banded together to start the Save Our Local News campaign. The campaign was created in collaboration with Media Workers Union Unifor, and after raising $55,000, a new publication, founded by veteran local journalists Mario Battelle, Janice Clue, Cornelia Naylor, and Teresa McManus, has finally launched. The publication is named Freshet News, and it serves to provide local news coverage to the communities of New Westminster, Burnaby, and the Tri-Cities. To learn more about Freshet News, what the plans are for this publication, and how they want to set themselves apart as a nonprofit newsroom, we sat down for a conversation with Cornelia Naylor, a longtime local journalist and co-founder of Freshet News. You know, this is a bit of a long time coming. I know that the Save Our Local News campaign was kind of going on all throughout the summer and resulted due to the closures of three Glacier Media, well, now Lodestar publications, the Burnaby Now, the New Westminster Record, and Tri-City News. Could you give a bit of a timeline of, you know, the layoffs happening, those publications closing, to you sort of banding together with these other journalists that were also part of the same publications and creating Freshet News?
First, I'm so impressed that you've been following this whole thing for as long as it's been going on. I mean, the timeline's been pretty short when you consider what we're trying to do, but yeah, it does feel like a big accomplishment to have launched our website last week. Okay, so timeline. I guess we would say that it starts back in 2023 when Glacier Media, now Lodestar, decided to close our print publications. And then after a couple of years after that, they shut us down completely, saying that for financial reasons, they said. And we think one of those financial reasons is that they left money on the table when they closed the print product. That's why we think that part is significant. So we found out in February that they were going to close us down, and the Burnaby Now shut down. Well, I guess we both did at the end of the Burnaby Now and New Westminster Record, and then the Tri-City News. We were on different collective agreements, so our closure agreements were slightly different, but I think we all shut our doors at the end of April.
At what point after the closure did you decide to band together with some of the other journalists that were part of those publications?
Well, we kind of just were set or reconciled to just kind of going our different ways, I think, and looking for other jobs, that kind of thing. But we were approached, we were thrown a lifeline by a co-op developer who approached us, various social medias and emails that he tried, and eventually we met with that organization, the Union Cooperative Initiative, and they said that they thought this would be an excellent idea or an excellent opportunity to create a co-op model to save local news in these three communities. And so that started shortly after the closures were announced, and then we didn't really start working on it in earnest until we were closed altogether with that organization.
I know throughout the summer you were out and about in the community at different events. What was the engagement process like? You know, what were some of the things you were hearing from people regarding, you know, the pretty distinct lack of local news that was occurring at the time.
Yeah, I would say our first few community events happened after a few weeks, maybe even a month after we shut down entirely. Our websites were gone. There was no more local news flowing. And people were really upset and really happy about the idea of us coming back. What we kept hearing over and over again is that people did not know what was going on in their communities. They didn't, just basic events, which kind of surprised me. I always thought that was kind of just a add-on in our news coverage and stuff, is just events listings. But people wanted that. Even though you can Google that stuff, I guess they want it in one place for their community. So that was one thing they missed. And the other thing was City Hall coverage, which I thought was really interesting too, because that at least is one of those things that doesn't really get a lot of clicks online, and it was something that was kind of not exactly that coverage wasn't exactly supported and encouraged from our corporate owner. Mm-hmm. Because it didn't generate a lot of clicks online.
Yeah, I mean, I think that ties into another question I had, which was just how is Fresh, you know, as a news cooperative going to differ from the previous publications that you worked for? You know, is there going to be sort of a difference in the kind of stories you tell or the ways that you're telling it? You know, it's less profit driven. So in this case, do you have the time to sort of focus on the more niche hyper-local that may not get as many clicks?
Yeah. When I first started 15 years ago in local news, we were writing good, solid sort of bread and butter local coverage, school board, city hall, the courts, lots of local news features and events, that kind of thing. And it's not that corporate media in the past with their local news outlets hasn't done that. They have done that. It's why people love and appreciate local news, even though they might have taken it for granted over these years. So I'd like us to go back to that kind of careful, you know, on the ground news coverage. And that's kind of what we expect to do, just basic, good local news coverage. The difference, I think, is that had been eroded by the time our newspapers closed. By that time, I was getting a little existentially angsty, and I think maybe my colleagues were too, about just becoming content creators. You know, it's just whatever bakery opening, not that bakery openings are not important, but just real clickbaity stuff that we were expected to just churn out, and lots of it. And I think with four journalists at the helm, because we are the ones making the decisions in this co-op, I think we're going to go back to, you know, we have to sort of slow ourselves down, get off the hamster wheel, and start doing that solid local news coverage again.
Mm-hmm.
And we're excited about that.
Yeah, and I mean, this has proven successful in other places. I remember the Save Our Local News campaign citing a similar thing happening in Quebec. Mm-hmm. And it and proving to be successful. I guess, how did that come about?
Well, yeah, that is kind of a model that we've looked for, at least a success story. So in Quebec, there were six daily newspapers, very much local news, but they were dailies. We were just free weekly papers. And they were going to all close because the corporate owner had the same sort of financial difficulties, I guess, that they ran into. So they were going to shut down six communities' news outlets. And the Quebec government, there was a big hue and cry. Politicians even got on board, I believe. But then the Quebec government stepped in with a $5 million, I think it was an interest-free loan or something like that, and they created a co-op, the same kind of co-op that we're looking at, a union cooperative, or where the members are union members as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going. Yeah, yeah, it's going now. That the shift to a co-op model saved those six papers. Our funding model, what we envision is that it will be advertising. We're looking at some sort of memberships, but we're still deciding what that means, membership or subscription. We don't expect that we will be putting up a paywall or that our paper will be something that you pay for, but maybe delivery to your home, like your front step, might be something that you pay for. Or certain content, certain parts of the content online might be things that we monetize. We're doing fundraising. We're right in the middle of another fundraising campaign. Our first fundraising campaign raised $55,000. So that's going to be important for us to continue campaigning and fundraising, basically. Since launching, we've also launched another fundraiser. And those are people really excited about local news actually flowing. And that was so encouraging for us. That and we're looking at grants. We're looking at everything we can.
Mm-hmm. When can we expect the physical newspaper, if there's
any
news on that?
Oh, right. We haven't even talked about that.
Yeah.
Well, our stretch goal is to have a print product. Right from the get-go, what we talked about was we think that people in the communities want print. We've talked to people in the ad industry, an ad agency, former ad sales people, and when they heard from their clients, their advertisers, they said they, you know, the company expected them to move over to digital advertising, and they didn't. Those advertisers just dropped off. So we think that there are a lot of people out there, especially in the community, that want people in their own community, they're the people that are going to come to their stores that they can advertise in print. Those are the people that are targeted with the paper. So, if we can manage to get enough support, if we can manage to monetize the website like the way that we need to, then hopefully we'll be, our goal is to launch in the spring, to get a print publication out in the spring.
So the last couple questions I wanted to ask were, I guess, more personal ones, looking into the backgrounds of all the journalists involved within Fresh Air News. You're someone who's been involved within local journalism for quite a long time, 15 years or so?
And I'm the one who's been in local journalism the shortest time. Between us, we have like 100 years of local news coverage experience. One of my colleagues is, I think both, two of them are have 30 years of experience in local news. So,
yeah.
Actually, I think all of them do, now that I think about it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was just curious, like, what keeps you here?
It's an excellent question. It is such a fun job. The variety of it. I mean, as a local journalist, you cover everything. I love animal stories. They're always so weird and quirky. You get to sit down and talk to people in your community, and life is both stranger and more beautiful than fiction when you talk to certain people in the community and you can really get into those stories. You know that the coverage that you're doing of civic institutions like City Hall or the school board or the courts really matters because nobody else is doing that coverage. They're you know, they swoop in if a story is really interesting. And in the past, that's how the bigger outlets have gotten some of their scoops and their stories, is that they follow up on local news reporting. And that's a thing that's eroding and is really important. But on a personal level, I just love it. I love being in the courts. I love, the people you get to meet. The dedication to craft, the storytelling itself, the variety. It's never done. You can never do it well enough, but it's always a great challenge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The publications closing earlier in April. Do you feel like you were always like acutely aware of the importance of local news, or was it something that like really put it into perspective for you once it was gone, essentially?
Yeah, that's a great question, because when you ask me personally, I've always loved this job. It wasn't like it's you don't know what you got till it's gone, in terms of my own personal enjoyment of the job. It's but since the papers closed and we've looked into why people are concerned about local news disappearing, and even the fact that it's disappearing at an alarming rate across Canada and North America and possibly the world, but definitely in Canada, has made us more aware of its importance societally. There were a couple of reports written earlier this year, or that came out earlier this year, that really underline that. One of them said that when communities, it's data coming out of the States, that when communities lose their local newspaper, they tend to retreat into more partisan corners. And we've definitely seen that in the States and in Canada more and more. When you lose your local newspaper, people go online and they retreat into their ideological corners and just throw rocks at each other. there's nothing that they can share, like a community news feature that can, at least they're in the same reality, you know, and fact checking, and people that are dedicated, you know, professionals in terms of making sure that the facts that they put out can be trusted and that we've done the best we can to verify the things that we're saying. Those things are important so that people don't retreat and become more divided. And that to me is a really important concern in democracy today. The other thing was the idea, the other report said, that local news is like the bedrock of good journalism, a good journalism ecosystem, and therefore really important for democracy in for that same reason that I was talking about earlier, that we are on the ground in those communities covering things that other people don't. Those institutions that really affect people, like the bylaws and the decisions coming out of City Hall, what happens in their local schools, what happens, what their police force is doing, what their fire department's doing, we're there giving people the information they need to make informed decisions as informed citizens. And that's just key to democracy. Those are all things, to answer your question, those are all things that have become more and more front of mind for us, or even just we've just realized them more, you know. We didn't realize how important we were. It's crazy to me that now you have a website, our website, and there would have been nothing had we not, you know, established it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
to
even
your point. Yeah, it's.
Yeah, I mean, even the Burnaby Beacon recently, I think I had a merger with the Georgia Strait.
That's right.
Like, it seems like a lot of it is either being dealt with in mergers or just straight up closures.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense. Those were the questions I wanted to ask, but I guess the last thing I'd want to ask of you is if there's just any other information regarding Freshet News and the work that all of you are doing that you would like our listeners to know about.
Well, they can sign up for our newsletter. They can visit our website, freshetnews.ca. And what we really want to do with this publication, to answer part of another question that you asked earlier, how do we want to be different? We want to be more engaged in the community. We want to hear more from our readers. We want to be able to have community events or events where readers can come and meet us and we can talk about stuff and different ideas for engagement. We haven't quite nailed all of those down yet, but we do want to hear from you. We want to hear letters. We want news tips. Sign up, subscribe, visit us.
Sounds good. I mean, and for those of you listening, CJSF would also love news tips as well. So if you can send those over to both Freshet News and CJSF.ca, please do. All right. Thank you so much, Cornelia.
Excellent. Thanks for having me.
Once again, that was our interview with Cornelia Naylor, a local journalist, reporter, and co-founder of the newly launched publication Freshet News, which aims to provide coverage for the areas of Burnaby, New Westminster, and the Tri-Cities. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This interview would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
CJSF Radio is climbing to new heights, and we need your support. Fund Drive launches next week, and your donations will help us rise higher and reach further.
This is Bird Note. Swans like this Hooper swan are impressive animals. They're among the largest flying birds around today. But 11.5 million years ago, two extinct species from Japan took an even more epic direction. Like today's swans, Anica cygna hajime and Anica cygna yoshiensis were quite large. But unlike their modern relatives, these birds lived most of their lives out at sea, and their fossils reveal remarkable adaptations to this unusual lifestyle. They had wide, spatula-shaped beaks, somewhat like modern shoveler ducks. The dense bones of their wide hips let them remain stable on choppy waters while filtering plankton from the sea surface with their oversized heads. Their wings weren't built for flight, but had the musculature and range of motion to suggest they weren't useless. In combination with the flexible tail, they could form a cradle for carrying chicks on their back, which some swans still do now with their young. The remarkable anatomy of Anica cygna reveals a creature uniquely adapted to thrive in an environment quite unlike what you'd expect for a swan. To quote the scientists who named it in a 2022 study, in a sense, it is the ultimate bird that ever existed. For Bird Note, I'm Ade Ben Salahuddin.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvetterani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Long COVID is a chronic medical condition that can consist of long-term and sometimes debilitating health issues as the result of a previous COVID-19 infection. The Museum of Vancouver's newest exhibit documents the everyday lives of people living with the condition, which, according to Statistics Canada, has now affected up to 1 in 9 Canadians. The exhibition is simply titled, Living with Long COVID. For this exhibition, the Museum of Vancouver collaborated with researchers from Simon Fraser University's Faculty of Health Sciences and the Post-COVID-19 Interdisciplinary Clinical Care Network. The exhibition is primarily photography-based, with clusters of pictures and text provided by individuals living with long COVID who agreed to participate in the exhibition. To find out more about what the exhibition entailed, CJSF visited the Museum of Vancouver, where we were able to speak with Viviane Gosselin, the museum's curatorial lead. The first question we asked was, how did this exhibition and collaboration with SFU and the Clinical Care Network come to be?
Yeah, so excellent question. I will say that about half our exhibitions are proposed by people, partners, organizations outside the Museum of Vancouver. So we remember receiving a call from the Faculty of Health Sciences. So Rakib Tesfaye, who's a researcher there, approached us and just called me by saying, we work with long haulers, like so people living with long COVID, and doing research on the subject, and yet working with long haulers, they have told us that they feel invisible, and would like to work on something public where they can express themselves and talk about this issue.
Next, we asked what the community response has been like so far for this exhibition on living with long COVID.
I will say for the long haulers, when they come here, and we met quite a few actually on opening day, and the general sense was they were pleased and happy to see themselves, even though they had not necessarily participated in and submitted photos for the project. They saw themselves, they felt heard, felt seen. So that was, that was very positive because that was like one of the goals. The other goal was public awareness, right? Like destigmatize also the topic of long COVID because it is misunderstood. People don't want to talk about it, or people feel judged because people are if they're talking about their symptoms, because there's not a lot of public education on the topic, these individuals feel that like the message they get is it's all in your head. You should try to do some yoga and a bit of exercise and you'll feel better.
We then asked what reactions they received from individuals attending this exhibition that may not have been informed about long COVID beforehand.
There's, members of the public who, really hadn't planned to see an exhibition on long COVID, but just stumbled upon it. And we hear their comments, we do some tracking, and we can see people are surprised. Again, they're surprised by how little they knew about the condition. And also about the severity of the condition. Like the people who submitted, the vast majority are homebound. And their kind of their daily life has changed radically since getting COVID and living with the aftermath. And for people in the public health sector, I hope it's going to be a bit of a shakeup, right? Like when museums are partnering with research centers in making this more public, it means that it has to be felt in like daily practitioners, like physicians should know more about it. And also it is underdiagnosed, right? So if practitioners, health practitioners are more attuned, they may be able to refer their patients to specialists and support them in their healing or just kind of stabilizing their condition.
Afterwards, we asked Ghazlain if she could go over some of the experiences depicted by those living with long COVID who submitted photos and text for this exhibition.
Part of this project, it's a photo-based project, it's about self-documentation and representation, and we said that part of the constraint, if you want, is document your day, and you can submit one and up to six images for that day, right? And so what strikes me is when people are making reference to their life before, like everything that they were doing, and how, for example, now just going and walking a short walk around the corner or just walking your dog for 15 minutes will completely like drain them. They have to go back to bed, right? So that's struck me, is how their life has been, like kind of their day-to-day life has been, like the life, their universe has shrunk, if I can say it that way. But at the same time, we see great efforts to, figure out how to feel better, document their conditions, like a lot of kind of resourcefulness, and they know that they have this one appointment, and like prepping and researching and trying to understand best they can, like, so a lot of agency in that, like kind of trying to take some control over their condition. Looking at when I keep seeing like pets, like dogs and cats, I think provides great comfort to people who have them. Like it's something that they mention. It's like, I don't know what I would do if I didn't have, so and so. So I think that presence is, alleviates, if you want, some of the symptoms at times. But we also see these photos where someone made little stars out of like the many pills and supplements they have to take. So a lot of people are showing their bottles of medication and prescribed and not prescribed, and creating their own, cocktail. And again, this is not filtered by a medicalized eye. This is very much the lived experience of long haulers. So we're not saying, hey, this is your treatment. Like for those who, this is them sharing what they're living. And I think whether you're from, you're a researcher or a scientist or just a member of the public, I think essentially we're asked to bear witness. If people had not given any thought about this issue, this is the time to think about what that means. And given the high number of Canadians, so one out of nine has experienced long COVID, thinking about our friends and neighbors, and like, guaranteed, Danny, that you know people who are living with long COVID. And so how can we help? How can we support these people?
Lastly, Viviane Ghazlain left us with what she hopes people are able to take away from the Living with Long COVID exhibition at the Museum of Vancouver.
I'd say come, and I'm in awe with the courage and honesty of long haulers. I, you know, have deep admiration, and yeah, I'm humble, and I hope that people will come, because the more we get to understand the experience of these people, but also the context and the condition, because there's our partners at SFU had, you know, had produced short texts about what is long COVID and what are the symptoms and the kind of impact it has. I think we have a responsibility to educate ourselves.
Once again, that was our conversation.